Welcome to the AR Show, where I dive deep into augmented reality with a focus on the technology and uses of smart glasses and the people behind them. I'm your host, Jason McDowell. Today's conversation is with Chris Pickett. Chris is the CEO of Digilens, a company on a mission to enable the next generation of waveguide-based AR displays using their proprietary waveguide technology. Chris laid the foundation for his career by earning degrees in engineering and law. He then went on to become the head of technology licensing, or the CEO, at four startups and a couple of other companies that focused on innovating and licensing technology and intellectual property around semiconductors, image sensors, and optics. Most recently, he was the president and CEO of Pelican Imaging, which was acquired by Tessera. In this conversation, Chris shares his perspective on the importance of waveguides in creating eyeglass-thin smart glasses and what sets Digilens technology apart. As Chris explains, most waveguide optics are complicated and expensive to manufacture, but Digilens has a different approach. He talks about his background in licensing IP for unique materials, designs, and manufacturing approaches, and the strategy they'll be using at Digilens. And we talk about the recent $50 million they've raised from the likes of Niantic, Universal Display, Samsung, Sony, and others, and what those investors mean for the future of the business. He goes on to comment on what he views as the best type of early customer.
We like to see customers that know their end experience, their user experience, as opposed to customers that come to us, and there are a lot of customers, that potential customers that come to us with specs for field of view, for resolution, things like that. I don't actually think those customers are mature enough to know what they want yet. Whereas a customer like Niantic that starts with, this is the end experience that I want. How do we work backwards and deliver that experience? That seems to be the right approach.
As a reminder, you can find the show notes for this and other episodes at our website, thearshow.com. That's thearshow.com. Let's dive in. Chris, in the mid-90s, you joined a company that really had a wonderful perspective on what was coming in terms of mobile phones and the desire to shrink that technology and bring it towards what we today expect as a computer in our pocket. Can you tell us about that experience?
Sure. That was my first startup called Tessera. And it was a company that was built around what became to be called chip scale packaging, where the package on the chip was the same size as the chip so that you could shrink down the package chip to as small as it could be shrunk down. And then we were trying to aim that first at this emerging memory technology called flash memory for the application for cell phones. Because cell phones, they wanted to do two things. They wanted more functionality, and they wanted to be smaller and smaller over time. And that's a very difficult thing to do. So we worked with a variety of the flash memory companies in order to get them to adopt our technology, but not adopt it from our factory, because they never would want to ship their chips to us as a small startup company. So our business plan at that point was to take our suite of technology, to license it to those companies that they were comfortable having as their suppliers for high volume packaging, and to allow them to make these packages in volume for our eventual customers, flash memory customers. And so we worked for a number of years to get that going. You really need a tremendous infrastructure around that effort, infrastructure in terms of companies to make these packages, companies that would buy these packages, and then for their chips, and then companies that would accept those for their end user products. So you need an entire ecosystem in order for this type of high volume product to get out there. So that's why we went to licensing in the first place.
Is this an example of an early fabless chip company? As we think of Qualcomm today, this brilliant technology, but often not manufacturing their own stuff. You end up partnering with others to incorporate that technology directly into their chips.
It's an example, actually, of one step even beyond that, which is to not only have a fabless type of situation, but to allow these companies to have their own customers, to have the licensees have their own customers and develop their own customers for the technology. So you're providing the technology they're not having to invest in the fundamental R&D to make that technology work, but they're able to leverage that technology into high volume customers.
You spent a good 13 years or so working there, and you saw the rise in that time from the early days of going transition from analog to digital mobile phones and into the early days of smartphones, pre-iPhone, and even up to kind of the launch, the true mass market of smartphones with the launch of the iPhone. So you're there for a good number of years. What are some of the key takeaways that you took from that experience as you'd apply it now to today's smart glasses market?
So I think the major takeaway is when you're going to a new platform, which in the early days really was happening in mobile, the potential volumes are so high that you can't think about doing it yourself. You need an entire ecosystem to build an infrastructure of support. For instance, if you were going to build a car, the car in and of itself is not enough. You know, you got to have the component makers for the car, the tires, the interior, the chassis, the engine, with the motor. But you also need the highways. You need the gas stations. You need the convenience stores, if you want to say that. And that's the entire infrastructure that's required for a car to actually work, for people to buy cars in volume. So the same thing actually was true at Tessera. You needed an infrastructure to create an ecosystem around massive volume, the types of volumes that mobile was starting to see and actually did end up realizing. I think we're seeing the same thing here in AR. There's a variety of different AR markets for end user experiences. Many of them are, I think, will be served by the smart glasses. But if you look at this as the next platform, which I think is the expectation for many, there needs to be a massive infrastructure put in place, an entire ecosystem of support. And so what we're trying to do here at DigiLens is install a portion of that infrastructure for what we believe will be maybe the only waveguide displays that can be made at a cost point that's low enough for consumer devices.
And that's really the key. As you focus on DigiLens, we can get into the specific piece of the infrastructure, the contribution to the overall ecosystem that you're tackling there at DigiLens. As you noted, you're making waveguide technology. And for listeners, that's the technology that gets the light from the display system and redirects it into your eye, so you can see both the outside world as well as the digital information that's being overlaid. Maybe you can describe a bit the particulars of the waveguide technology itself and how it fits into the overall needs of the smart glasses market.
Sure. Let's start with smart glasses themselves. We're assuming that we can get a new device into the hands of people, and they will want to do something as bold as put it on their face. And that's a pretty bold thing to think about, because people have big egos. You know, they when they put something on their face, they want it to be stylish. They want it to make the statement that they want to make. And they want potentially to have that drive and experience that is sufficient or is good enough for them to want to put that on their face. So when I look at displays for smart glasses, there's a fair number of different types of displays. I think waveguides are the only ones that will eventually be able to actually make at least the consumer jump, the jump to a consumer product, because ultimately the waveguides take, as you said, the light from the projector system or the display panel and manipulate it in a thin sheet of glass or potentially plastic, and then present that to the eye of the user. So ultimately, it looks like glasses that you would have on your face anyway. It's that thin, that light, whereas a lot of the other technologies that people are using are much bulkier. They add a lot of weight. They add a lot of size. And I don't actually think that's going to be adopted in a mass market way because of that.
And so there, you're really speaking to our vanity, I guess, which is something that each of us holds.
That's
very
exactly
dearly,
right?
We want to look good. We want to feel confident wearing these things. And if we can't overcome that hurdle in terms of the weight, the look, the bulk, the stylishness of the overall system, then we're not going to wear it.
That's exactly right. I think vanity is the perfect word for it.
And how is it that waveguides distinguish themselves from other approaches to redirect that light from the display into the eye? Certainly, we talked about some of that bulkiness, but we can talk a bit about the technique that it's using.
Sure. In waveguides, typically, there's three basic approaches that are used. And each of the approaches essentially takes the light from a light source, captures it within a thin sheet of glass or plastic, manipulates that light in a way that then projects it into the eye and makes the information appear projected out at distance. So there's beam splitters that are used in waveguides, and those are pretty good for certain applications. There's something called surface relief gratings, which is essentially a diffractive grating that's etched directly onto the surface of a sheet of glass. It's a semiconductor process done with semiconductor equipment. And then there's what we do, which is the use of a photopolymer material that essentially, through an exposure step, reacts to the light that's exposing it and self-assembles into a Bragg grating, which is a different type of grating that's used in fiber optics today and has been used for quite some time. It's extremely efficient at transferring the light from one point to another. And because we use a photopolymer approach, we don't have to etch the surface of glass and use a semiconductor process to do that. And that puts us at a wholly different lower cost point.
And so here, the overall objective is to stuff all the light that's coming out of the display into these really thin sheets, these waveguides, and then efficiently move them through the guide, through the glass, until it gets to the right point where it needs to be redirected into our eyes. And the approach you're talking about, the image that flashes to mind is kind of like a photolithography, I guess. Like
It's a little bit like the analogy I would make is photocopy. Or you could say a photograph, right? And exposing the photograph in order to get the chemicals on the sheet of a regular photograph to show the image. So we take a sheet of plastic or glass, we inkjet print our material on it, we then laminate another sheet of plastic or glass. And so you have an encasement of glass, our material and glass, or plastic, our material and plastic. You then put a mask in front of that and you scan a laser across it. And as that laser goes through the mask, it imprints a diffractive pattern into our photopolymer by when the light hits the photopolymer, it reacts and there's a phase separation of the materials within the photopolymer, pushing them and self-assembling them into a hologram of diffractive gratings.
That sounds, on the surface, from my layman's ears, a highly scalable approach to being able to produce these things in volume.
Well, so we think it's highly scalable. We think it may be the only way of making these types of waveguides at a cost point, also that can hit a consumer price point for smart glasses.
What are the display requirements that go in front of the waveguide? Are there benefits or detriments of using an OLED display versus a DLP display versus an LCOS display in combination with waveguide?
There are. You need to consider field of view that you want the experience to have. You need to consider the resolution that you want the people to see. You need to consider the size of whatever display you're using, and then ultimately the cost of that. And all of those work into whether you can get to a product that is sufficient for the application, there's an enterprise application, a military application, or consumer application that makes sense. So if you look at, for instance, potentially the hardest thing to do is a consumer application because the costs have to be very low. And yet the expectations are pretty high with respect to field of view. People want an immersive experience, resolution. People are used to seeing their images on a high-end LCD or a OLED panel. So the resolution is very high. And then if they're going to put it on their face, the size has got to be very, very small. And the weight has got to be small so that it feels comfortable on their face for long periods of time.
Speaking of field of view, since that's a topic that certainly comes up a lot, there's a lot of brouhaha recently when Microsoft announced that they doubled their field of view. And people interpreted that initially to be a linear sort of diagonal doubling, but in fact, it was an area doubling, which is less exciting. And regardless of, I guess, your opinion over the necessity of a large field of view, people are very excited about having a larger field of view than what is currently out there. What's possible with the sort of technology that you're creating today?
So we think that we can go from where we are now, which is we're supplying markets for essentially what is a HUD market, a heads-up display kind of glasses market, that 25-degree field of view or 30-degree field of view. We'll very shortly be coming out with a 50-degree field of view. We think we can expand that to a potentially a much broader field of view, 70, 90, 100 degree field of view. And certainly from a binocular standpoint, we're looking, we believe that we can get to about a 90 to 100 degree field of view sometime next year.
Wow.
Now, I want to say that at the same time, that's an amazing statement because it produces a tremendously exciting experience if you've got the right software on top of that. And we think that we can do that in the waveguides, but we also need other parts of the infrastructure to come along. And we were just talking about the display panels or the projectors. At the same time, you need a field of view and a resolution to fill out all of that field of view on the display at high resolution. And then to do that at a size that's small enough that people will still want to put it on their head. So there's a real pain point. There's a pain point on the waveguide display side, and there's a pain point on the projector or the panel side as well.
From your perspective, have you seen what is the right path, in your opinion, to getting the panels to having the set of characteristics that are necessary to take full advantage of what you're going to be able to offer through the waveguide itself? Is it DLP? Is it LCOS? What's the right path?
So it depends on who you talk to. From our perspective, there's a number of different directions that we see that could potentially work. There are OLED panels, micro OLED panels. And the fundamental issue there is brightness. You know, they're high resolution, but are they bright enough to display information in the waveguides? Especially since when you're talking about certain of these markets, they have to be bright enough to go from inside to outside. We call it daylight bright, you know, to be used outside, right? And the OLED, micro OLED panels really aren't right now. So there's a lot of work, some corners with people doing that work. Micro LED is a promising technology to provide high brightness in a very small space. And I think the only question in people's minds with that is, when is it going to be ready? And I think there's a timing issue there. And it depends on which company you talk to. But it appears to be a couple of years away. Some people are using DLP. And DLP has a very mature market right now. There's a lot of manufacturers making DLP projectors. They don't tend to go beyond about 720p right now in resolution. And for that type of resolution, field of view is not as wide as you want it to be. And they're relatively large, you know, larger than you'd want them to be, and at a cost point that's higher than you'd want them to be. Ultimately, I think the last type of technology is kind of laser-based scanners or laser-based sources. And we're seeing some of that coming to the forefront, for instance, in the HoloLens. HoloLens 2, they're using a laser scanner approach. It's pretty complex, and I would guess pretty costly, but pretty interesting. There are other laser approaches that we're seeing now from other companies that may also be very promising. Laser kind of LCOS combinations. So we're watching all of those things, and we're working with a number of those companies in order to make sure that when we're coming out with these wide field of view waveguides, there will be a light source that we'll be able to use that to show off the full extent of the waveguide.
You're preparing for all possible fronts at this point as you continue to make the technology better. One of the challenges that these smart glass makers have as it comes to the visual experience, that some, I'll pick Carl Gutag as an example, but Carl will often talk about his dissatisfaction with some of the visual experience through some of these technologies and products ultimately. But often the critiques end up being around kind of this, the challenges of mixing this outside real world light with the digital information that you're trying to project as well. And part of it is falls on the shoulders of the display itself, as you just described, and part of it falls on the shoulders of the optics, the whether it's waveguide or whatever it happens to be, the optics technology that's redirecting that light into it. Maybe you can talk through some of these characteristics a bit, and you can talk to it at least from the perspective of your waveguide technology. And maybe we can start with transparency and this idea that if something is really going to be safe to be used and allows a user to fully consume the outside world as well as the digital information, that display, that visual experience, the optics, I guess, in this case, needs to be transparent. How much of that light from the outside world ends up in your eyes using your technology?
So with the DigiLens technology, we're super efficient at transferring light to the eye, which means that our waveguides can be highly transparent as well. You know, what we're seeing right now with depends on the number of layers of waveguides that we're using for a full color waveguide. But for a two layer full color waveguide, we're getting about 92% transparency.
Wow, that's pretty good.
For a three layer, it's a high 80s. It's about 85 to 87%. So very good in comparison to most of our competition.
Yeah. And how efficient is it? Like how much of that light that gets thrown off by that panel ends up in the user's eyes?
So our efficiency, we've seen between 5 and 10% efficiency on getting the light from the source to the eye. And that doesn't actually sound very high. But when you're talking about waveguide efficiencies, most of those efficiencies are sitting between 1% and 3%. So by using the Bragg gratings that we talked about, we're able to get several times more efficient waveguides at transferring the light from the projection panel to the eye.
Yeah. And that translates to having ultimately a brighter visual experience, brighter display, right? So you can either make do with a less bright actual display panel and or a very bright display panel and transmit more of that light into the user's eyes so they have effective visualization of that digital content even in daylight viewable, as you described.
Exactly. I mean, ultimately, it translates into the flexibility for the experiences. With our waveguides, you can go outside. You can still see bright imagery. So you can use it in really any inside or outside application. I think with most of the other waveguides that are out there, that's not true.
If you take a look at birdbath optics or some other optics where the display is separate from the optic and you're kind of bouncing the light off of that optic, you can throw all the colors at the optics at the same time and it reflects all the colors simultaneously. But my understanding is with waveguides, with most waveguide technology, each of those slices, each pane of the waveguide itself is tuned, highly tuned to a single color of light or a very narrow band of light. Is that the case?
That's exactly right. So if you want to get a full color RGB display, typically you start with three layers. You'd have a layer where the gratings or the elements that are manipulating the light are tuned to carry that wavelength of light. So you'd have a green layer, you'd have a red layer, and you'd have a blue layer. What we're able to do, because we are so efficient at Transmitting Light is have two layers for full color as opposed to three in some applications. So we tune one of the layers for blue and part of the green spectrum, and one of the layers for red and the other part of the green spectrum. And that reduces the total amount of brightness that we can get out of it, but it also reduces the total cost of the waveguide.
Very cool. Help paint a picture in my mind here. So if I have a traditional panel of some kind, each one of those pixels is usually comprised of several subpixels in some formation, but it usually includes a red, a green, and a blue, horizontally, kind of separated on the screen. How is it that the red pixels end up in the red waveguide and the blue pixel light ends up in the blue waveguide? How does that work?
Well, so there's a variety of ways to make that work, but typically you have an input grating that captures a particular wavelength and turns it into the waveguides so that it's bouncing back and forth within that particular waveguide.
Got it. So it's a filter on the front.
And then you can spatially separate where the blue comes in, where the red comes in, where the green comes in. We have a second technique that we can use because our gratings are made of liquid crystal elements, and liquid crystal can be used passively or it can be used actively. So we can apply a voltage across the input gratings in some applications and turn them off, clear the gratings so that the light passes straight through and isn't manipulated or turned into a particular waveguide. No other waveguide in the world can do that. No other waveguide in the world has that functionality right now. So we can also operate our waveguides in an active mode and simply switch which waveguide is accepting the light.
So fascinating. What was the original insight? Right, going back, this is a different approach, you know, the Bragg gratings. As a different approach than the other waveguide makers are using. What led to the key insight that kind of started the company off in its origin?
Yeah, so our founder, Jonathan Waldron, is a fascinating guy, brilliant guy, really. He was a pioneer in virtual reality in the 90s. He was setting up VR systems that were much bulkier than the systems now, but pretty high quality, actually, even comparison to what's being used now. And he was setting them up in commercial arcades and for the military. And what he decided at one point was he wanted to do something similar, but to shrink it down and to make sure that people could use it while they were walking around in their everyday lives, which obviously you can't do in VR because you're completely closed off. So he started looking around and trying to figure out how to do that. And he came up with some fundamental ideas about using the switchable Bragg grating technologies, in part from what he saw in fiber optics, and applied those principles over into waveguides.
So that insight led him to build a company around this approach. And he was really excited from the very early days on this idea of having wearable technology that would still allow you to interact with the outside world, this idea of smart glasses that we're all trying to make happen here.
That's right.
How long ago was that?
So he started the company in 2003, and it was started actually as a company that did laser backlighting and things like that for TVs and other types of displays. And it wasn't until later that he pivoted towards transparent displays of the type that we're talking about now.
Got it. What have been the major milestones is after that pivot, as you guys have made your way to today, what have been the major milestones on the path to making the product that you've got?
I think that the first major milestone was the first real customer that worked with the company in the early days to get a product onto the market. And that in the early days was a customer called Rockwell Collins, who's now called Collins Aerospace. To put a combiner heads-up display into the cockpits of commercial aircraft. And that's a product that's actually being sold today. It's about 4 inches on the side, and pilots can sit in the cockpit, look up at this transparent display. It doesn't obstruct their vision because they can see through it, but they can see super bright image coming at them as well. And they can put any information up there that they want to put up there. And it's very, very compact, so it can be put in very small cabins.
And this is not something tied to the helmet itself. This is something that's in the cabin of the cockpit of the jet.
That's exactly right. So it was a small combiner HUD. And then we went from there to trying to generalize that and miniaturize that for glasses-based applications. And so if you look at where we are from there to here, there's been several rounds of funding with some extremely high-quality strategic investors. And we, you know, as you know, we just closed a $50 million C round, which is a fair amount of money. But what we're really proud about is not really the money, it's the relationships that that's created and the programs that we now have with those companies. For instance, Continental led the round. They put in half of the money for the round. They are the world's leader in heads-up displays for automotive applications. They have about a 30% market share for automotive heads-up displays. The other companies that came in that round, Samsung, clearly a leader in displays. Sony, clearly a leader in VR and consoles. Niantic, a leader in augmented reality software. In fact, maybe the leader with Pokemon Go and the new Harry Potter game. Mitsubishi Chemical, who's the number one company in plastics technology for glasses applications. And as we migrate our glass-based waveguides over to plastic, they're the number one company that you would think about or dream about interacting with. Universal Display, who has our exact business model of licensing technology and building an ecosystem, but in a different market, which is the OLED market. They're the biggest technology provider for OLED phosphors and OLED technologies. And then the two other strategic investors we have are Foxconn and Panasonic. What I think we're starting to create is a tremendous interaction with these leading companies to create an ecosystem, to create the type of infrastructure that's required for high volume production for a number of different markets.
That's a really amazing list of strategic investors. It's an all-star list. One of them stood out though, right? Several of them are involved in producing displays or working with the hardware side of it. By Niantic is really a software and experience company. What got them so excited about what you're doing?
I think they've been fairly vocal about trying to drive a new type of experience over time for the applications, for the games that they're putting out there. They're location-based games based off of the screens of your Android phone or your iPhone are great and tremendously successful. But if you're able to put a different type of display on your face that gives you your hands back, you're then able to interact on a gaming basis in a much more immersive way. And so when we, kind of generalizing from that question, when we look at customers, Niantic as a potential customer is exactly the right type of customer that we like to see. We like to see customers that know their end experience, their user experience, as opposed to customers that come to us. And there are a lot of potential customers that come to us with specs for field of view, for resolution, things like that. I don't actually think those customers are mature enough to know what they want yet. Whereas a customer like Niantic that starts with, this is the end experience that I want. How do we work backwards and deliver that experience? That seems to be the right approach. If you look at some of our other customers, for instance, Continental, they start with, we are the world's leader in heads-up displays for automobiles. And instead of providing a small heads-up display like it's being provided now, we want to provide three lanes of data visualization. And we want to be able to push that data visualization out to infinity so that we can attach it to the world. We can attach arrows to the ground, to the pavement, to tell people where to go so they never have to take their eyes off the road. Those are the types of customers that know the experience that they're trying to drive that ultimately are the best customers to work with because you can define the hardware sufficiently for that. And then we take it one step further And we give them the ability to either make it themselves by licensing the technology to them and then providing our proprietary photopolymer material and process to them. Or we can install that in their manufacturer of choice so that that manufacturer can make it at volume for them.
As you think about fundraising for a company like this, how do you think about this kind of decision around having strategic investors investing at this point in the startup's life cycle or the market's life cycle? What's the thinking process behind bringing in this kind of A-list group of strategic investors at this stage?
The thinking is to bring in those customers that are leaders in their respective areas and to give them a reason to be successful when we're successful. So as we deliver on the technology, then they can then deliver on the volume, we both win. And really, at this stage of the company, a venture investor doesn't bring that same sort of value. A venture investor does bring money, and they bring contacts and relationships, and those are valuable. But a strategic investor that is a leader in the field typically knows exactly what the end application should look like, and they can help you accelerate to that point. And that means accelerating to volume, and that ultimately means accelerating to revenue.
Revenue acceleration. You talked a bit about two key markets that will ultimately leverage the waveguide technology. One is HUD. Automotive is certainly one area for that. Aerospace, another area for that, but I'm sure much higher volume in automobiles and airplanes. And the other is smart glasses. And smart glass sales today are meager compared to where everybody anticipates they'll be several years from now. How long do you think it'll take until we get to a mass market sort of device? Like, when do we get to 100 million users?
I think that's the billion-dollar question, right? We believe that it gets to kind of the 100 million user type of figure by about end of 2024, really more like 2025 and beyond. And you get there through these first applications where people can understand the experience and can drive to particular markets, whether it's kind of these fans of certain location-based games coming together all in one city, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people all at one time, looking for the best experience that they can have with their friends, running around catching Pokemon, right? Or driving and needing to know not only where they're going, but whether it's okay to let go of the car and let the car drive itself, when they need to take over control. All of that type of information can be driven to the driver. I'm not sure if I completely answered that question, but
it'll be a while, right? I mean, there's lots of opportunities between now and 100 million smart glass users to have significant volume of the right sort of waveguide technology. As you're designing this, right, you have this new infusion of money. You're continuing to iterate. When I saw you at AWE, you were showcasing a design of the waveguide that was actually leveraging plastic instead of glass, which is a really big deal, certainly when it comes to weight. But where are you focusing your current R&D efforts right now with this new infusion of money? Like, what are the areas that you intend to continue to improve upon?
We're looking at a number of different areas. Generically, we're a display company. So we're looking at displays for small displays for near-eye displays, smart glasses, things like that. Larger displays also for things like automotive heads-up display for pretty wide field of view visualization within a car. There's a number of different areas that we could also look at, like collimated light sources for backlight units and things like that. I think it's really important for a company at our stage, though, to focus. We have to be really choosy about what we do. We have to say no more than we say yes in terms of both the applications that we're working on and the customers that we're working with. So we're really focusing in on consumer and enterprise smart glasses and on some of the larger display applications like the automotive heads-up applications.
And what's the barrier from where we are today to being able to satisfy those use cases in the way that those customers need to be satisfied? Is it really about just customizing based on each individual customer's needs at this point, or are there still some fundamental technical challenges to overcome?
Most of the technical challenges have been overcome. There's still some that need to be worked on depending on the market that you're looking at. But most of those have been dealt with. If you look at smart glasses, we are working this year and next at making wider field of view glasses. But given where we are and where we need to go, that's not fundamental R&D, it's really engineering. So we're taking our designs and we're making them wider field of view.
And the other that I just kind of hinted at there is that you are also creating these waveguides out of plastic. What's the extra challenge that plastic poses over glass?
Well, so plastic is ultimately the material that you'd want to use if you were making smart glass displays, because it's lighter than glass. It's ultimately less expensive than glass, and it's safer than glass. But it's also not as flat as glass. And when you have light that's bouncing back and forth between the surfaces of a substrate, flatness is a really important thing. Also, it's more permeable than glass. And so you've got to deal with the likelihood that moisture will come into the system and have an effect on system performance. So all of those things have to need to be locked down. And that, again, goes to why we want to work with a company like Mitsubishi Chemical. They know more about plastic than we will ever be able to learn. They know more about plastics for glasses applications than anybody in the world. And so when you look at getting super flat plastics, plastics that can have a barrier layer to stop the moisture ingress, and things like that, they're really the partner that you'd want to work with.
There's another great reason in selecting that particular group of strategic customers. It's not just about having accelerating sales. It's also truly about partnering to deliver innovation in a way that is beneficial to the market. That's very cool.
That's right. And no one company can do everything. And in the plastics area, we're going to deliver plastics. There's no way we could do it by ourselves. So associating companies that have fundamental competencies that we will never have is the right way to go.
As you look out across the various other players in the market, who or what in this industry makes you the most nervous?
I think everybody's a little bit nervous about how the market unfolds. And so if you look at that, everybody kind of has looked towards Apple in some sense to lead the way because they have a closed garden system where they provide the entire experience. And in mobile, for quite some time, people looked at what they did and they iterated on that. We really need that type of leader to provide hardware and a way for the software to interact with the hardware smoothly. So you see it, a number of different companies trying to do that. Microsoft clearly with HoloLens. Magically, clearly with the Magic Leap 1. Everybody thinks, you know, Apple will come out with something at some point, and I think that's probably true. But you need those types of things to set certain standards so that other people can build around those standards. And right now, we really don't have that type of standardization yet. So there's a lot of uncertainty driven through the market because of it.
Still early. And it's not clear at this point which of those, well, it's certainly not clear when Apple's going to release anything. And while Microsoft and Magic Leap are out with things, there's still a lot of uncertainty as to who is going to be the big winner. Because while the technologies in those products are really impressive, they haven't yet taken the market by storm. And so there's a lot of uncertainty as to who is going to be the winner and which of these platforms are really going to be relevant 5-10 years from now.
I think that's right. And really who ultimately breaks down to not only the hardware, but who's operating system are you going to use? Are you going to write to it? There's a number of different components that need to be standardized, just like they needed to be standardized in other large markets like smartphones.
Yep. As you navigate kind of the set of opportunities that are in front of you and you define the value that you're delivering to the market, what is it ultimately that you are delivering? What is it you're licensing to your customers for the waveguide technology?
What we think we're licensing is a full suite of technology that will allow them to make waveguides themselves and design waveguides themselves for their customers. So that starts with our photopolymer material, which is the best photopolymer on the market. I think there's only really two companies right now that are moving down a track of photopolymer, as far as we can tell. One is Apple with the Aconia purchase. It's a type of photopolymer. And then there's us, who we're really licensing and offering our photopolymer material broadly to a number of different companies. So we start with the photopolymer. We then combine with that a process and machinery that puts that photopolymer down and builds the waveguide. We also have a series of pieces of software that design the elements within the waveguide to manipulate the light and to model the performance and the construction of those waveguides. We license that as well. So we try the best that we can to provide a full suite of technology in terms of the photopolymer, the process, and the design and modeling software so that people can design and manufacture their own waveguides for their own customers. I liken it to teaching them to fish instead of giving them a fish.
Yeah, as you're describing it, I kind of think of the ink, the printer, and then the Photoshop app, right? You design whatever it is you want to come out the other end, and then you're selling them the approach, which is the printer in this case, to manufacturing it, as well as the ink, which is the photopolymer, in order to actually make it happen, kind of a key component in that end product.
I think that's a good way to boil it down.
So your own background is very heavy into technologies where there's a lot of IP innovation, and then you're licensing it to others for them to incorporate into their products. What are the pros and cons of licensing this sort of technology versus building, manufacturing, and shipping, for example, in this case, waveguides, to customers that meet their specs?
So licensing is about leverage and about doing what you do best and allowing the people you interact with to do what they do best. We believe we're the best in the world at technology for waveguides. We are not the best in the world for high volume manufacturing or for integration of total systems. And if we tried to do that, we would dilute our effort. So by taking what we do best and combining what other people do best, you diversify the risk in order to get to volume. And you provide a path to creating an ecosystem or an infrastructure for high volume manufacturing, which needs to happen anyway. If you look at the possible, what everybody thinks are the likely projections for just smart glasses with waveguides, there's no way we could create a manufacturing plant large enough. So that business model is broken if we tried to do that. So instead, we go to our manufacturers. We associate those companies that want to have these types of products, that want to play in this next platform. And we allow them to manufacture it for eventually what will be the suppliers of the smart glasses. And if you look at it from the opposite standpoint, the suppliers of these eventual smart glasses, whether it's Apple or Microsoft or Magic Leap or Huawei or whoever it is, they don't want to come to a small company for waveguides either. For these displays, they want to go to qualified high volume sources. So licensing is a way to get that leverage to build that infrastructure, to build that ecosystem so that the entire product base, the entire platform can be realized.
Are there risks on the IP side? I imagine what comes to mind is this fashionable purse that gets manufactured with the appropriate brand, and then out the back of the factory, they're shipping a knockoff version of this brand, right? Whether that applies to some sort of clothing, high fashion brand, or it applies to chip technology or software, we hear many stories about IP being stolen or leaked. How do you protect against somebody stealing your IP?
So that's a really important part of any licensing business model. There's always a risk of bad actors. And sometimes it just comes down to a financial calculation where they say, I can do this and not pay you, at least for a while, and that's a better financial calculation for me. But really, early in a technology market, when you're looking at a brand new platform, that's a lower risk than you would think. Now, the risk typically comes later when the market has unfolded, the platform has become more clear, people are trying to jump on the platform as quickly as possible, and then you've got the risk of people not wanting to join the same group that created the platform. And so you need to have thought through those impediments that are sensible to make sure that when people look at that, the best course of action for them is to simply license the technology. And so if you look at it from, for instance, Digilens' perspective, we have a proprietary photopolymer material. It's actually very hard to reverse engineer. So that would be the first impediment, if you will. You need the photopolymer. Our licensees, the people we work with, they need us to provide the photopolymer for them to make these displays. The second element is a value, really, is the software for designing the elements that manipulate the light within these waveguide displays and model the behavior of those displays. We provide that. There is no commercial software right now that can give them that functionality. So that's an element of value. It's also an element of risk if somebody tried to do it on their own because they can't get it any other way. The process is maybe a little bit easier to reverse engineer, but unless you have the photopolymer material, the process, reverse engineering that process doesn't make any sense because the process follows what the photopolymer material does. And then ultimately you've got patents, and patents are important from the perspective of just telling people, hey, not only do I have all these elements of value, but I also have these elements that I believe we own that if you want to use, we're happy to provide those as well. If you want to do it yourself and engineer around those patents, there's potentially a way to do that, but we don't believe that you can. So it's really, there are always risks for bad actors, but you want to make it painful for bad actors.
Got it. Definitely a multi-pronged approach to both protect and properly incentivize your customers to behave in a way that's honorable and ultimately valuable for them.
That's exactly right.
Let's wrap up with a few enlightening round questions here. What commonly held belief about spatial computing do you disagree with?
I don't believe that spatial computing will first start out in a general way. And if you talk to a lot of large customers or potential customers, many of them come with a spec sheet. I want this field of view. I want this resolution. You ask them, why do you need that field of view? And they don't know. And you say, what's your end experience? And they can't tell you that. Or they can tell you, but it doesn't match up with the spec sheet that they give you. So I think that you have to start with an experience and work your way back. And so I think that, like in many applications, you start with a group of fanatics, people that love what they do and they want a better experience. And then you generalize out from that.
Is there a particular group of fanatics that you think have the best kind of early use case around smart glasses?
I love people like the people that are running around doing Pokemon Go or Harry Potter or those location type games, because any group that travel long distances to be involved with a bunch of other people that are doing the same things is willing to extend their behavior to have a better experience. And that's really what we're talking about. And then when you look at that, provide that experience over time, as you learn about it, to a broader and broader range of people. You could say the same thing about, you know, Continental and the driving experience and things like that.
Well, also comes to mind a group of fanatics that are willing to travel long distances to get together with other people doing something similar. Sporting fans kind of fit in that realm as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Besides the one you're building, what tool or service do you wish existed in the AR market?
So we talked about this earlier. I think the display panels or the projectors are a key pain point for smart glasses in general. I think having something that is small, relatively inexpensive, high resolution, wide field of view is not, you don't just roll out of bed and find that. And so do I wish it existed yesterday or today? Absolutely. And I'm hoping it's going to exist tomorrow. We're certainly trying to work towards that.
Yeah, for sure. What book have you read recently that you found to be deeply insightful or profound?
So actually, the last book that I read was a book that my daughter was reading in school also, which is actually something I hadn't read before, which is 1984. And if you want to find something that's relatively profound, the dystopian future that is explained in 1984, where there is kind of complete control of a society in almost every fundamental way, that's a pretty good source to go to.
What's amazing about that story is that the technology that exists in that story is not dissimilar from the technology that we live with today. A microphone in every home with all these cameras everywhere. The opportunity, at least from a technology perspective, for somebody who is not here to pay attention to everything that's happening in your home, that exists today. The difference is who is taking active access of that and control from it. But yeah, it's a wonderful story.
That's right. It's not only just cameras and things like that, which you have in concert with that today, is all the information that's being collected by the different sources on the internet. Giving people the ability to quantize populations in a way that has never existed before. So actually, I think we have a society that that's not the society that's described in 1984, but you're right. The same sort of technologies that are discussed there and the same sort of behaviors could happen. And really, we should think about those technologies and how to implement them in a way that is beneficial to society as opposed to not beneficial.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as we embark on this next major phase of personal computing that smart glasses help bring forth, we need to ask ourselves again, what's okay? Because we're going to have even more insight into what each of us are thinking and feeling and doing and interact with in any given moment of the day.
Yeah, I think that's right.
If you could sit down and have coffee with your 25-year-old self, what advice would you share with 25-year-old Chris?
Well, so many things. I think probably two things pop. I would tell myself that you've got to be smart in your approach and extremely persistent, at least in the technology sector. Being smart in your approach and being persistent can lead to success. The second thing I think I would tell myself is don't do anything you wouldn't want to be covered on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, which is something a friend of mine used to say in college when you're in college, you're running around doing crazy stuff. But don't do anything you wouldn't be proud of and wouldn't want on the front page of a major newspaper.
That's good advice. I think persistence is probably one of the hardest things to truly appreciate at 25, where you kind of grew up in a world where it's very structured prior to that through the educational experiences that you've got. And things, the grades come, the end of the semester comes, you graduate, these things kind of come on a regular schedule. And life is much messier than that. And when that success doesn't come on a regular schedule, I think it's quite easy for people to give up. And that persistence is really key in that time.
I think that's right. And so this is my fourth startup. Fifth or sixth company, depending on how you count it. And when you're working in startups, you're trying to do the improbable most of the time. And it's really that persistence that many times makes the difference. It's your ability to see through things that are very unclear and to keep moving towards the goal.
Yeah, absolutely. Any closing thoughts you'd like to share?
I would say, because we're talking about smart glasses and augmented reality, I truly believe it's the next platform. And it's going to be a very large market of the sort that we saw grow over time in mobile. If that's right, if that fundamental assumption is right, then it's not enough for one company to come out with a device. We need standards. We need infrastructure of technologies. By technologies, I mean a variety of different technologies that have to come together. And ultimately, it all has to come together in an ecosystem to provide the right experience at the right performance points, at the right cost points for whatever market that it's being aimed at. I think that's what we're trying to do at Digilens. I think that we've got the right performance characteristics. We're trying to associate ourselves with the best companies in their respective areas and only really pick those customers that deeply understand what they're trying to do and experiences that they're trying to deliver. And then wrap that into an ecosystem that can help them deliver that.
Wonderful. Where can people go to learn more about you and your efforts there at Digilens?
Ultimately, they can go to the Digilens website. They can go to the LinkedIn. I'm certainly there. If they want to contact me directly, I think that the best way to do that is through LinkedIn, and I'll respond from there.
Awesome. Chris, thanks so much for the conversation.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Before you go, I want to tell you about the next episode. In it, I speak with Chandra Devam. Chandra is the co-founder and CEO of ARIS-MD, a company incorporating conventional scanning technologies and their unique data visualization software to deliver X-ray vision within AR and VR across a number of medical and industrial use cases. In this conversation, Chandra talks about growing up in a silo on a farm with no running water and how it sparked her imagination and creativity. She describes the unique approach she and her partner, Scott Edgar, are taking to enhance surgery as well as industrial inspections and ultimately save lives. Their efforts launched them to the winner's circle of the 2019 NASA iTech Cycle 1 competition, where NASA seeks out the best emerging new technology that will enhance future space exploration and humanity as a whole. I think you'll really enjoy the conversation. Please subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss this or other great episodes. Until next time.